From the Moon Broadcast Center, this is Air Talk. Good morning, I'm Larry Mantle. L.A. Mayor Garcetti's ordered an elite LAPD anti-gang unit to stop pulling over as many cars as it's been doing for the past couple years. The mayor reacted to an L.A. Times story showing the percentage of African Americans pulled over is far greater than for other groups. Will the shift have an effect on criminal gang activity? We'll take a look after the news.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering three psychology master's degrees this April. Priority deadline to apply for summer term scholarship is February 15th at gsep.pepperdine.edu.
Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Such pleasure to have you with us. All the choices on the dial. Appreciate your spending time with us here. Coming up, a look at the economic plans of several Democratic presidential candidates. They're each touting their approaches to reducing the gap between lower and higher income Americans. We'll talk about their ideas for making a more progressive tax system. First, L.A. Mayor Eric Garcetti's calling for the LAPD's Metropolitan Division to stop pulling over as many cars as they've been doing in recent years. Just over 3 years ago, the mayor announced the elite division would double in size to fight increasing crime. And that's led to a dramatic increase in the number of vehicle stops in the city. The L.A. Times recently reported African American drivers were five times more likely to be pulled over relative to the overall population than drivers of other races and ethnicities. In South Los Angeles, where gang activity is more common, the percentage is twice as high for African Americans than for other groups. But given that the proactive approach to policing is designed to crack down on the subset of gang offenders, is the overall population comparison relevant? Joining us to talk about the issue is Alberto Retana, who's CEO and president of Community Coalition, an outreach group based in South Los Angeles. Mr. Retana, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Larry. I appreciate it.
So what do you think is the best sort of comparison to get at what would be a reasonable breakdown in ethnicity or race for those that are stopped?
Well, I think the first step is the recognition that racial profiling is unconstitutional to the Fourth Amendment of the United States Constitution. And we got to really stick by those rules if we're going to do the work that we believe in. South Los Angeles is the argument that is often made that we need to patrol African-American communities because that's where the violence is. Well, Latinos, as myself, lives in the same neighborhood. We're not getting pulled over at the same rate. So this is not an issue of smart deployment. This is actually a violation of our rights.
Now, we know that immigrants are typically lower level of criminal offenders than those that are born in the United States. That's what studies tell us. So is it fair to say that looking on average that Latino South Los Angeles residents and African-American South Los Angeles, particularly young people, which is the young males, which is the greatest group of offenders, that on average, the gang membership and criminal activity would be the same?
There are Latino gang members and African-American gang members in our community. It's a small portion of our community, but they definitely are there. But the issue here is about aggressive policing and whether or not aggressive policing is even working. And it is our sense that it's not working. And what it's doing is it's making folks feel more unsafe, not just from the residents that they're afraid of, but also from those who are supposed to protect them.
What have you been hearing from South L.A. residents about the stops and what are some of the concerns that they've shared with you about how this has played out?
Look, 2 years ago, we had face-to-face conversations with 4,200 South L.A. residents, 20 to 30-minute conversations. 80% of the people we spoke to said they have experienced racial profiling. That is an alarming statistic. When the report came out by the L.A. Times, it verified their anecdotal experience, And it's unacceptable in a city that claims to be so progressive to be behaving like Ferguson. It's just not acceptable. It's an embarrassment.
We're talking with Alberto Retana, CEO and president of Community Coalition, which is a community outreach group based in South Los Angeles. Also with us from the John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York City, professor of law and police science, Peter Moskos. Professor, good to have you with us again.
Yeah, it's good to be on your show.
So your thoughts about this disparity, the racial disparity that we see in the numbers overall in Los Angeles and particularly in the South L.A. community?
Well, of course, it gets to a lot of tricky issues of race and crime in America and in L.A. I mean, the study by the L.A. Times was incredibly simplistic in that it's comparing police activity to the overall population in Los Angeles. As Alberto pointed out, there also, you know, when you narrow down to specific neighborhoods, you also see disparity. But the question then becomes is how do we address racial disparity and violence crime? I'm afraid the result of this and what the mayor has said is simply that we're going to have less policing, and that will lead to more violence. And in a city where 95% of homicide victims, of people who get murdered, are Black or Hispanic, of course police are going to be disproportionately focused on minority communities. The question is, are they doing it right? And that's what the data doesn't show. It's possible, and I don't know, that cops are being sent out there saying simply, you know, pull over people, stop people, generate stats. And cops can do that, but that is mindless and potentially racist policing. But even good policing, and look, homicides are down almost to a record low, right? I mean, it's, what, 258 last year, I think? Second lowest as far back as I can tell. Something seems to be working. And the one way to increase police legitimacy is to actually be effective police officers. And it would be a shame if you saw Los Angeles go backwards in the way that we've seen in other cities like Chicago or Baltimore.
If the LAPD stopped doing stops generally, what do you think would be the effect on crime? Because if the stops are precipitated, by communities where crime is higher, and that's going to skew the race or ethnicity of the stops, is that something that the good outweighs the harm? If it destroys trust in law enforcement, if it makes law abiding residents of color feel as though they're being picked on, does the decrease in crime justify that feeling of being picked on?
Well, hopefully you can have a win-win scenario. I mean, if you just send in police as an occupying force, that's problematic. That's unconstitutional. But you can also send it. It's not, you know, the questions, are they stopping random people or are they stopping people based on reasonable suspicion and legally stopping people? Perhaps for pretextual causes, perhaps because they suspect something. But this, if it's based on their experience and training and professionalism, if it's not based purely on race, then that is good aggressive policing. But you need to focus on the correct people. You can't just sort of generically come into a neighborhood and say, you know, we're putting it on lockdown or something like that. And that goes back to tricky issues of police oversight, of effective leadership, of accountability, and to a large extent, even transparency. I mean, it's important to – here's the thing. The Metro unit might – and I don't know, they might be a part of the crime decline. My inclination is to give them the benefit of the doubt. But you also see patterns of when policing goes bad, when it goes rogue. It's always specialized units. I mean, of course, Rampart comes to mind. It's always sort of specialized units that are focused on violent crime. It doesn't mean it's inevitable, but it does mean you have to watch these units. But when violence is down, police should be applauded. And the response to that isn't to say, let's stop what works.
We're talking with Peter Moskos, John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York City. I welcome your calls as we talk about Mayor Garcetti's order to the Metropolitan Division of the LAPD to back off of the large number of stops that it's made. I think last year, if I'm not mistaken, 60,000 stops that were made. And the Los Angeles Times, in its story, writing about the racial composition of those, that for African-American drivers, five times more frequently pulled over relative to the overall population. In South Los Angeles, African-American residents twice as likely to be pulled over as any other group. 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722, or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Alberto Redondo, the Community Coalition, did I hear you wanting to say something there?
Yes, sir. Sorry about that. I just wanted to note two general points. One is that the pretext stops that they're using are broken taillights and paper plates. And I think that so far that what we've seen, and we think that that's problematic. Don't know what the science is or the correlation is. The police department has yet to provide that data, and it causes alarm to think about when we think about data-driven policing, what is the data they're using both to deploy but also to evaluate the effects that they can't even share at this point, though we'll be able to hear from that in a few months. So we think that's incredibly problematic. And we also know that what has been working is not the aggressive policing, but the intervention, the work that gang intervention workers have been doing to work with gang members to get them out and to not retaliate when things emerge. There are other models that have been deployed in Los Angeles that are led from the community, community-driven efforts that we have seen have had a big contribution. It's why the statistics are different today from 25 years ago when the city blew up in flames because of the aggressive policing and the lack of community-informed intervention. What we're asking for is for the community to be involved. Look, you have community. I'll just close with this. You have communities that don't members that don't want police, and you have community members that do want police. But most community members, what they don't want is to have their rights violated, to be profiled, to be have their dignity taken away, and that's what we have. We have an opportunity, and the city has an opportunity to tackle today and create the safe communities we all deserve.
We're talking with Alberto Retana of Community Coalition. He's CEO and president of that community outreach organization based in South Los Angeles. Peter Moskos, Professor, John Jay College, Criminal Justice, New York City, with us as well. We're at 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Mr. Rentana, from the people that you've been hearing from in the community, do you know if they've been informed when they've been pulled over, the reason that they've been pulled over? Has that been disclosed to them?
Well, yeah, you know, they had their tags on their plate or their broken taillight. It's not like folks were pulling over. There's absolutely nothing there. There is a pretext, but the pretext is not about giving them a ticket for having a broken taillight, which could eventually result them going into jail, county jail, for numerous circumstances. But it's never explained to them when they're being pulled out of their car, they do a search. Those are the kinds of things that are incredibly troubling and problematic, and is what is dehumanizing to our community to experience that when it's not happening at the same rate, especially in South LA, when Latinos are a greater share of the population. Immigrants and non-immigrants alike. I just think that contradiction is glaring, and I think it blows a hole in the theory of focusing on African-Americans.
Peter Moskos, your thoughts about what would be a reasonable percentage that would indicate there's not racial profiling going on, that there's not a particular race that's being targeted by police?
Yeah, I can't give you an exact number, but let's say police only stopped murderers. They had 100% success ratio. Mind you, there'd be a lot fewer stops if that happened. You would still have a racial disparity where blacks would be overrepresented four times, according to their population in Los Angeles. That's what I mean about there's an inherent disparity that's going to happen, and that has to be delinked when appropriate from racial bias. And that's why the LA Times study bothers me, because it really didn't do that at all. There are also, you know, consistently polls, and these aren't L.A. specific, but this often shocks people, particularly liberal white people, that black Americans want more policing more than white Americans do. Crime is really important. And the efforts and the outreach efforts and the community organizations that Alberto was talking about, it's not an either-or scenario. We can have both. The problem is often you see the advocacy for community-based organizations at opposition with effective and more policing. You need both. It takes everybody to get this job together. But the important part is that police have to be seen as part of the solution and not just part of the problem.
And interesting, you just mentioned about African-American residents asking for more enforcement in their community. Stephen Gardina said, I'm African-American. My family lives in the 77th District. And I read the report in the LA Times. And what's missing is they're not paying attention to the victims. I've lived my entire life in Los Angeles. I agree with the professor's analysis. That's Steve in Gardena. We're at 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. How much, Peter Moskos, of the decline in violent crime and homicides could be related just to the fact that we are seeing overall, if I'm not mistaken, nationally, a decrease, particularly among, you know, younger gang age member population in committing violent crimes?
Well, a lot of it, but we don't know is part of the problem, which is why we can't sort of let up on that. But, you know, crime trends vary by locality. So, you know, last year, violent murder was down a bit in America. The previous 2 years, it was up significantly nationwide. And Los Angeles kind of bucked that trend. But you see huge differences in different cities, and that does not relate so much to historic issues, which matter at a grand level. But at a local level, the poverty rate didn't change when violence went up by 2/3 in Baltimore in 2015. Historic racism and segregation didn't change in Chicago when violence shot up, and then it's gone down more recently. These crime trends are independent of the social factors that are very important, but the social factors that a lot of people sort of want to put all the emphasis on as causing crime, and we just don't see any data to back that up. Crime is local, and so solutions have to be local, and we also have to deal with violence given the hand of cards that were dealt.
All right.
You know, given the problems that America has, given the problems that are in LA, what do we do about it now? And so you do see a lot of effective solutions, but it just always worries me when there's that, and we have to have less policing on top of it. And time and time again, we see that leads to more violence if we take proactive policing out of the equation.
Let me bring Alberto Rotana back into the conversation from Community Coalition. You want to respond to what Professor Moskos is saying?
Well, I think that I would just say that for the community, one, this is an opportunity to get the community involved, because those that are directly impacted, most to gain, most to lose, are often furthest away from the policy table. So to the extent to which we can open that space up, that would be incredibly important. And to the point of what effective policing is, we believe from our experience that the Metropolitan Division's approach to aggressive policing, not just proactive policing, but aggressive policing, is ineffective. And there is other models of intervention that are community-based, that are less about suppression and cracking heads, that has resulted in officer-involved shootings. Most officer-involved shootings in South L.A. have been about Metro officers. So we have to have a conversation around what is the effective policing that is taking place, if any. What are the elements of community support that has come in that's actually moved the needle over the last 25 years? And I believe that's the mental health diversion, that's the gang intervention work. There's a program called Community Safety Program that's being tested out, that's been doing really good work, that's less about that, but really getting officers to knock on doors and build relationships. We're talking about building trust. We're talking about building safe communities. And we're also about talking about how do we maintain the humanity in folks and not violate the Constitution of the United States. I think that legal action is called for here at some point if the department is unwilling to move. I applaud the mayor's efforts today, the decision that he made to pull back that particular type of policing. The African Americans hopefully will feel some relief in the next few months from not getting pulled over for simple pretextual reasons that have nothing to do with the crime that's taking place in the neighborhood.
I want to thank you both very much. That's Alberto Rotana of the Community Coalition. He's CEO, president of the South LA-based organization. And Peter Moskos of John Jay College of Criminal Justice, New York, professor of law and police science. You can share your comments about Mayor Garcetti's mandate to the LAPD's Metropolitan Division to stop pulling over so many people on the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Back in 1 minute. The field of Democratic candidates for president continues to grow, and for many of the candidates, a central part of the candidacy is a plan for shrinking the gap between the lowest income Americans and the highest income Americans, whether that is a far more progressive income tax, a specialized tax against high earners, or other ways of raising revenue to be redistributed. With us to talk about the range in those proposals, Michelle Hackman, domestic policy reporter for The Wall Street Journal, recently wrote an article on this very subject. Michelle, thank you for joining us.
For having me.
First of all, what are sort of the commonalities? Did I sort of get that right in the intro about it's generally about greater progressivity in the tax code?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think what's new here, and first I should note, you know, every presidential campaign, we see presidential candidates trying to come up with policies that feel new and fresh, like, you know, something that they're adding to the conversation. And this feels like a major pillar of what Democrats are trying to talk about. You know, you hear Democrats talking about rising income and wealth inequality and really trying to emphasize that as a central campaign message. And they're really going beyond what typical Democratic proposals are, you know, things like expanding safety net programs like health care, housing assistance, public education, and really talking about how do we get cash, how do we get dollars in the hands of, you know, low and middle income families where wealth isn't accumulating as quickly.
You write about Cory Booker, the most recent announced candidate, the New Jersey senator, who wants to provide every newborn with a $1,000 interest-bearing savings account. What's the philosophy behind that that Booker is proposing?
Yeah, I think his is one of the most novel proposals. As you said, it would create interest-bearing bank accounts, kind of like a college savings account, where the government would put in $1,000 and possibly more throughout a kid's lifetime to make sure that children who are born into any kind of situation, maybe who don't have families who are able to save for them, have some kind of wealth building in their name. I think that's how he would frame it.
And Kamala Harris, our California senator here, a proposal for families making less than $100,000 a year, tax credits. What sort of tax credit? What size is she talking about?
Yeah, so it's a similar idea. It's, you know, putting cash directly in the hands of lower income people, but she's using the tax code. She's proposing to create an entirely new tax credit that would go to families making up to $100,000. So, you know, a couple would get up to $6,000. And she's saying you can redeem that at the end of the year or even monthly for things like rental assistance, food assistance. And that would just sort of come in direct cash as a refundable tax credit.
Are any of the Democratic candidates talking about increasing the child tax credit?
Yeah, they are. So Sherrod Brown in particular, who hasn't declared his candidacy but has said he's mulling running for president, has talked about, you know, increasing the size of the child tax credit. So Republicans actually doubled it in their 2017 tax law, but I think he'd like to see it increased even further.
And he's also calling for an increase in the earned income tax credit?
That's right. He's talking about as much as tripling it.
All right. Senators Harris and Booker, they're also proposing financial assistance for people who are paying high rent or mortgages. How much assistance are they discussing?
Yeah, so that proposal is another bill in the Senate, is really focused on people with high rent costs. So they're saying, you know, for people who spend any more than 30% of their income on rent, that the government should sort of step in and pay the difference. And the way that the mechanisms are slightly different, but essentially what they're saying is the government should be, again, giving cash to those people to sort of subsidize the high cost of housing.
We're talking with Wall Street Journal domestic policy reporter Michelle Hackman. She wrote a recent piece looking at the Democratic presidential hopefuls or declared candidates and how they're touting their methods for approaching what they call income inequality, put it in a more neutral term, just closing that gap between lower-earning Americans and higher-earning Americans. We'll take your calls, your thoughts about some of these proposals at 866-893-KPECC. That's 866-893-5722 or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Of course, Senator Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts has really built her reputation on a consumer focus and on tax policies that she sees benefiting the middle class and lower income Americans. Has she gone beyond what she has proposed as a specialized tax on the very highest bracket of taxpayers?
That seems to be Elizabeth Warren's big proposal, is this 2% tax on wealth. So she wants to apply it to people who own more than $50 million, such that, you know, above that threshold, their wealth would begin to be taxed at 2%. Now, that's a slightly different idea. What I'm talking about here is the government spending money in the form of sort of helping out low-income families. I think Elizabeth Warren is looking at the other end, where she's actually trying to figure out ways to bring in a lot more money to the government to be able to spend on things like either cash assistance or expanded health care, free college, things like that.
Let me bring into the conversation Benga Jalohri, who is a senior economist at the Center for American Progress, which a think tank that leans left in Washington, D.C. Mr. Jalohri, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
So your thoughts about these different proposals, what do you see as the potential trade-offs? I understand you're progressive, but do you see potential trade-offs in enacting the policies being introduced here?
Well, there's always going to be trade-offs with policy, but I think one of the things that we have to think about is think about this in terms of a bigger picture. And so we think about capitalism. You can't have capitalism without capital. And these plans are just trying to provide access to capital for people who've normally not had it. And so we want, you know, people participate in the economy. And so we've had these increased costs to education, housing, healthcare. And so some of these plans, like the tax credits, are there to kind of defray the cost. And then you think about the policies like baby bonds, that's to help increase wealth. So with wealth, people are going to be able to engage in entrepreneurship. They're going to be able to afford college, graduate school. And so it's a way of kind of looking at all these policies together to kind of help people to participate in this economy more fully.
So it's sort of the get ahead of the curve when you're talking about an account set up for a child, right? The idea
right.
being that they don't live their life always sort of behind because they can never get enough capital to invest, to buy a house, to do some of the things that can significantly improve one's standard of living.
Exactly. And you think about the stat that, you know, most people can't cover a $400 emergency. And so once you have that kind of capital, that wealth to kind of be able to weather some storms, this actually kind of even reminds me of what happened with the government shutdown, that a lot of these fellow workers were having difficulties, you know, making ends meet. And so if you have that big base of wealth, then you're able to kind of weather these storms. And then in good cases, if you have this wealth, then you're able to kind of take time to, like, maybe, you know, leave a job and try to pursue that job that you always, that business that you always want to start. And so we think about the people who were innovative, who are entrepreneurship, they always had that kind of base of wealth to help them get ahead.
We have a listener, JSK, writes on our AirTalk page, if people consider the logical consequences of Kamala Harris's subsidies for rent payments over 30% of income. I assume what JSK is talking about is possible distortions into the cost of rent or the cost to purchase properties, as well as how it might incentivize more expensive properties for people to rent. Mr. Jalohri, your thoughts on her proposal?
There's always going to be trade-offs in that case, but one of the things we have to think about is that you look at where the jobs are, and jobs for low-income individuals, that you think about commuting costs. And so you have people who live in metropolitan areas like Los Angeles, New York, D.C., who be able to afford a place, have to live 2 hours away. So they're commuting to work 2 hours there and back, and that's going to be not productive. And so if you have these kind of programs to kind of defray the cost, because we're not, you know, we're not providing free housing, you're just defraying the cost above 30%, then you have these people who are able to live closer, who are able to work more, be more productive, maybe save. And so we have to think about what are just not just the monetary costs that people face living in these areas. We have to think about kind of the other costs, the opportunity costs that they have. And especially if you think about housing costs in LA, Chicago, all these places where the jobs are, you think about, okay, housing is going up. How do we help these people out?
We're talking with Benga Ajilori of the Center for American Progress, senior economist there. And coming up right after our break, we'll be talking with the Manhattan Institute's economist, senior fellow Brian Riedel. He's been with us a number of times on Air Talk to provide a conservative perspective on these various progressive taxation approaches by Democratic presumptive or actual presidential candidates. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. We'll be back after a live update from Tammy Trujillo. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. I'm Larry Mantle. Such pleasure to have you with us. We wish Hedy Lyn Herdes well. She's under the weather today. Nice to have Tammy Trujillo at the microphone with the updates, and hoping Hedy gets feeling better soon. We're talking right now about Democratic presidential candidates or presumptive candidates' plans for addressing the widening gap between the lowest earning and the highest earning Americans. They have a number of different progressive taxation plans or direct payments that they're proposing to lower income Americans, either through earned income tax credits or other sorts of earlier payments. I'd like to hear your thoughts about it. What's your critique or your support as you weigh what trade-offs are involved? You think the ideas are promising? 866-893-KPCC, 866-893-5722, or the Air Talk page, kpcc.org. Joaquin in South L.A. writes on the page, you help people out by increasing housing supply. Giving consumers a subsidy doesn't help them if housing supply is nearly inelastic. That's just pocketed by landlords. That's Joaquin writing on the Air Talk page. With me is a conservative Manhattan Institute senior fellow and economist Brian Riedel. Brian, good to have you with us again. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Larry.
So your thoughts on and I realize the proposals are all different, but just sort of generally your thoughts about potential unintended consequences of these ideas.
Well, I think the first thing to look at is even before you get into whether or not the ideas are workable in a vacuum, and of course, anytime you give benefits to individuals, they're going to be better off. I don't challenge that. You have to look at the overall cost and the budget situation we're facing. Overall, we're facing a $16 trillion deficit over the next 10 years, even if we just leave everything as it is. The tax cuts are about $2 trillion of that $16 trillion. Overall, if you put together the cost, the baby bond proposal is probably about $1 trillion over 10 years. The Harris tax plan is about $3 trillion over 10 years. Then you add it to other promises we've been heard, Medicare for all, government jobs guarantee, free college, student loan forgiveness infrastructure. Those earlier promises add up to $42 trillion. And so my question is, when you're already facing a $16 trillion deficit, there's already $42 trillion in other promises, and then we have another $4 trillion in promises. How in the world are you going to pay for about $50 trillion in new promises on top of a $16 trillion tax cut, or sorry, a $16 trillion deficit? I think there's a million great ideas out there. There's no way to pay for any of it.
So if you significantly increase taxes for higher income Americans, and I'm not just talking about the super wealthy like Elizabeth Warren's talking about, but if you were to go to tax rates that might be, say 60-70%, something like that, you're approaching in some of the European social democratic countries, what effect would that have? How much could that raise?
For instance, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez has proposed 70% tax rate, would only raise about $200 billion over 10 years. And again, we're talking proposals that are in the trillions. If I can convert the numbers into percent of GDP, which is a little bit easier long term, we have a budget deficit that's heading to 7% of GDP and promises that are about another 17% of GDP. Now, according to the Congressional Budget Office, if we doubled the 35 and 37% tax rates all the way to 70 or 74%, we would raise 1.5% of GDP, which is about $300 billion a year. So according to the Congressional Budget Office, you could double tax rates on the rich, and you would maybe pay for Senator Harris's tax cut, and you wouldn't be able to pay for anything else that's been promised.
So it's what you're saying, there's just not enough of them. Is this like the California problem where we have a highly progressive state income tax and there's so few people at that highest end that pay a high percentage of the tax that you can't get enough out of them?
That's exactly it. If you took every dollar earned by millionaires in America, that would add 3.8% of GDP in federal revenues. Keep in mind, again, we're looking at a deficit heading to 7% of GDP and about 17% of GDP in new promises. So you would barely close half the budget deficit, even if you took every dollar from millionaires. Now, that's not to say that we can't raise any taxes on millionaires. That's not to say that the current tax system is perfect. I'm not defending that. But if you look at Europe, the way they finance their large welfare states is with significantly higher taxes on the middle class. They have payroll taxes in the 30% range. They have value-added taxes in the 20-25% range. Really, that's where most of the money is.
All right. And for the U.S. to go to a European model, what do you think the effects would be on the economy to adopt that?
Well, I think you'd probably have slower growth. European economies in general have somewhat slower growth. Now, I will say a lot of people in Europe prefer their model. I'm not making a value judgment here. For a lot of people, it's worth having slower growth in order to have this effect or in order to have this level of redistribution. But I think if you ask a lot of Americans, are you willing to pay a 30% payroll tax or a 25% national sales tax, a lot like Europe, I think a lot of families would be really concerned about that.
We're talking with economist from the Manhattan Institute, Brian Riedel, who's a senior fellow at Manhattan. Our phone lines are open at 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722. The AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Let me go back to the Center for American Progress's senior economist, Benga Ajilori. Your response to what Brian Riedel is saying?
Well, I just have a difficulty when people talk about costs, when we're talking about helping out low and middle income households. For the last 30 years, we've been having tax cuts, even the last plan just from last 2017, and no one talks about costs then, that we're okay with cutting taxes when it actually blows up the budget. And he had mentioned what the cost of was like $2 trillion. And so the question I would have is, you know, we have these issues. We have these wealth gap. For the last 80 years, we've seen the share of income and share of wealth grow for top, 10%. And it's not just, wealth from entrepreneurs and innovators, but also increase in inheritance. And so the question then becomes, we have this wealth gap, this increasing wealth gap. And, how do we close that wealth gap? There's people who want to participate in this economy. There's people who want to work, who want to innovate, who want to become entrepreneurs. But because of the increasing cost of education, housing, and healthcare, it becomes difficult for them. So what these candidates are trying to propose are ways of closing this gap, way of easing the burden. And so, we could talk about the cost of it and try to, be able to pay for it. But you just never hear about how to pay for it when it comes to tax cuts. We only hear about it when it comes to spending programs.
Brian Riedel, your response to that?
Well, I think, first off, I was concerned about the cost of the tax cuts, but I guess I don't understand the argument.
Brian, we're having a problem with your level. You're cutting out there. Can try again, please.
If you're concerned about $2 trillion in tax cuts, I don't think the proper response...
Brian, we got a problem. We'll try and get you squared away here on our break because your voice is cutting out as you're speaking. Again, I'd love to hear from you. We're at 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Sam in Sierra Madre says, I'm surprised so far that the candidates aren't running on a full repeal of the GOP tax plan. That's been very unpopular, at least so far. That hasn't been part of what they've been talking about. Kate tweets at AirTalk, supply and demand always have an equalizing point. If you give people subsidies, the prices will just go up. And if you stop the subsidies, there will be a massive housing crisis. You share your comment on the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. We'll continue our conversation with Michelle Hackman of The Wall Street Journal and economists Benga Ajilori and Brian Riedel back in 1 minute. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. I'm Larry Mantle. Pleasure to have you with us. We're looking at various plans that have been proposed by presumptive or formally declaring Democratic presidential candidates and their proposals designed to close the gap between lower-earning and higher-earning Americans. We're at 866-893-KPECC. Brian Riedel of the Manhattan Institute, I think we've got your phone thing squared away there. Brian, your response to our other economist, Benga Ajilori of the Center for American Progress.
Sure. I think in terms of the cost, I would say if you're concerned about the $2 trillion cost of the tax cuts, the proper response is to repeal the tax cuts, not to add a massive increase that even blows the tax cuts away. If we were just talking about, say, the Harris proposal, $3 trillion, you could say, well, that's comparable. But again, when you put it on the line of everything else being promised in free health care, education, government jobs guarantee, you're looking at $40 to $50 trillion. And I think it's hard to say one party didn't pay for $2 trillion, so we're not going to pay for $40 or $50 trillion. That would cause an economic collapse.
Let's talk about the gap. First of all, do you think that this wealth gap is significant, that it's a problem? And so then secondly, what would be your prescriptive using, you know, market forces, capitalism to achieve some measure of, you know, mitigating the gap?
You know, I think the earned income tax credit is a really good policy. And in fact, I think one of the concerns I have with the LIFT Act is that it kind of duplicates a lot of what the EITC is. I think we need to do a lot more for our education system. I think we need to have a lot better job training. And I think, you know, we can really significantly expand the EITC without spending $3 trillion over 10 years that the LIFT Act would propose. I think the EITC and programs like that are really good. I also think anything worth doing is worth paying for. That includes the tax cuts, and that includes these policies. And so it's just really important to find the pay-fors.
Let's bring listener Richmond in Palm Springs on Air Talk. Good to have you with us, Richmond.
Hi, Larry. I'm often upset that when people talk about how Americans may not like the cost of these things and paying higher taxes, they neglect to say that when they compare us to Europe, that Europeans who pay these high taxes, often universally, these social democratic countries in Europe have higher happiness quotients whenever they're studied, and the Europeans have a much higher quality of life than we do. We hear about Americans who are unhappy in the middle class or working classes. They're being left behind. They're struggling with two incomes. They can't keep up. Their costs are going up. And Europeans don't have these problems. I think if you told Americans their taxes would be higher, but their quality of life would increase, they might be less inclined to be upset about higher taxes if they knew that it was coupled with a higher quality of life and a higher happiness.
You know, one of the things, Richmond, I think sort of is at the center of what you're talking about. My perception is, and I'd be so interested looking at public opinion polling on this, is that Europeans generally have a higher regard for their government's delivery of services than Americans have confidence in our government to deliver services. I don't know whether that's actually borne out in surveys, but I wonder if that's one of the reasons that Europeans are more comfortable with higher taxation and the government having a higher degree of responsibility for service deliveries. Benga Ajilori of the Center for American Progress, do you have any sense of that?
I do. And I think one of the issues is that for the longest time, I think back to what Reagan said, that, you know, the scariest words in the English language is, I'm from the government, I'm here to help you. And so we've had this kind of mentality of that the government is the problem, as opposed to the government potentially being the solution. And so hearing that for so many years, that's kind of, people have a distrust of government. And then, you know, there's been a lot of emphasis on what the government does wrong. But, you know, again, you know, I go back to the shutdown where people realize what the government does. And so, like, all the things that the government does and the positive things that they do, people realize that once it was gone. And so I think if we understand that there's, you know, government could do things better, but there's a lot of things that the government does right, that if we emphasize that, then people have a better sense of what the government can do.
EGW writes on the AirTalk page, look at the migration in and out of places with high income inequality versus the migration rates in and out of places with low income inequality. The people from low income inequality countries migrate to high income inequality countries. That's EGW. Brian Riedel, Manhattan Institute, your response on this issue of public trust of government to deliver services.
Yeah, I think that's a big issue. People, the federal government, I think, has a not very good record in delivering services. I also would say that what can work reasonably well in a country of 5 million people or 6 million people is very different from what works in a country of 330 million people. They haven't tried, we don't have anything as ambitious going on in Europe as what's being proposed here. Additionally, a lot of the proposals I'm hearing, like the government jobs guarantee, they don't even do that in Europe. The Medicare for All plan has a level of generosity and low copays that even exceeds Europe. So I think actually one of the problems is what's being proposed with some of these other ideas aren't actually what they do in Europe. They're even more expensive and more generous.
Let me bring another listener comment in. Jennifer in Culver City, and Jennifer, I'll just ask it because we're short on time, says there are a lot of governmental costs that could be cut by not using private contractors. If the government did, it could deliver the services for lower cost. Brian Riedel, your response to Jennifer's contention?
The savings would be minuscule compared to what's being proposed here. It would be a fraction of a rounding error. That's how big the proposals being proposed are.
All right. And Bengaji Lowry, the Center for American Progress, where would you see the funding come from for some of the most generous of the proposals here? Do you think that you could increase taxes enough to come up with that revenue?
I would think so. I think the thing that we need to focus on before talking about the cost is to actually kind of, as a country, what do we want? We've had this increasing wealth gap, increasing income gap. And so the question is, are we okay with that? Are we okay with, you know, the top 1% getting more? Because in the TCJA, you know, we cut, you know, capital income, and we don't even tax capital income that much. And so the question is the wealth gap a problem? And if it's a problem, how do we close that? And so we look at what are the different kinds of policies. And in addition to looking at the different kinds of policies, think about, well, what are some of the revenue sources that we could tap into? But I think the debate right now is about what are the policies that we want to focus on and what may work, what might not work. What can we take from other countries? What can we take from ourselves? And so I think that's what the things about these candidates is that they're proposing many different types, you know, expanding the EITC, the LIFT Act, baby bonds. We have all these different types of policies. And, you know, we've talked about raising taxes, you know, AOC's tax on income, 70% income tax. There's Warren's 2% tax, that we have all these policies that we are proposing. Let's think about, how do we close these gaps? How do we help middle and low income families? And then once we figure out some of the policies we want to do, then we can start talking about revenue sources to be able to pay for it.
By the way, TCJ is the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act of 2017. I want to thank you all for being with us. Michelle Hackman, I'm sure, is going to be covering this, particularly as other Democrats announce their candidacy. She's domestic policy reporter for The Wall Street Journal and wrote very recently on this in the Journal. My thanks to economists at the Center for American Progress, Benga Ajilori, and Brian Riedel, economist at the Manhattan Institute. Thank you for being with us. We have a lot more to come in the second hour of Air Talk right here on 89.3. I'll tell you all about it coming up momentarily.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering 3 psychology master's degrees during the summer term. Convenient locations for working professionals in West LA, Encino, and Irvine. Graduates in psychology, marriage and family therapy, and behavioral psychology are prepared to pursue licensure or a doctorate in their designated field. Classes start in April. Apply by February 15th to be considered for a $3,000 scholarship at gsep.pepperdine.edu.
When an earthquake hits, you need to drop, cover, and hold on.
Definitely there will be the perception that the ground is literally waving in front of you.
But what do you do after the shaking stops? When the power is out, the roads are blocked. I'm Jacob Margolis, host of KPCC's new podcast, The Big One, Your Survival Guide. I've got plenty of answers for you. Listen in Apple Podcasts.
Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Just hearing Tammy's story about The Simpsons being renewed for two more years, and I think 32 seasons, 32 years of shows. That's remarkable. Then it hit me. God, I've been on longer than that. Hard to believe. Wow. Time flies. Great to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Coming up later this hour, our reporter Jill Replogle spent 30 days attempting to live single-use plastic-free. So is that really possible? And what do you give up if you do that? You know, how do you get the, you know, salsa from the supermarket? If not salsa, then other, you know, products that come only in a single-use plastic container. How do you avoid that? We'll talk with Jill about what this meant in her life coming up a little bit later. But first, yesterday, Southern California Edison, the private utility serving most Southern California communities with electricity, filed with the State Public Utilities Commission its wildfire mitigation plan for the year. Now, this plan is what Edison's approach is intended to be to deal with the risk of massive wildfires like we've seen the past few years here in California. Pacific Gas and Electric, of course, filing for bankruptcy. It covers the northern part of the state, Edison covering the southern part. It's not in bankruptcy, but obviously deeply concerned about liability from any major fires. With us to talk about what's in the mitigation plan is Sammy Roth, Los Angeles Times reporter who covers energy. Sammy, good to have you with us.
Happy to be here, Larry.
So let's start first with, I know one of the concerns for Southern California ratepayers is, you know, what's contemplated here, if anything, in terms of rate changes to fund the mitigation plan?
So that's a good question. So the plan that Edison's put forward, you know, looking past just this year for the next like 3 years, they're looking for what they say is about $582 million worth of, you know, activities to harden their grid and make it less likely that fires will be sparked by their infrastructure. So that, you know, that's money that would need to be approved by the Public Utilities Commission for them to then charge that to ratepayers. And it's, you know, honestly, it's not going to be something that's, you know, like a crazy huge amount. But, you know, if that's all approved, you're looking at maybe a couple of dollars per month per person.
All right. And then folks obviously concerned about having their electricity shut off at their home or their place of business. So what is Edison contemplating? What's the threshold where they might cut their lines off because of fire threat and that would knock out the power?
Yeah, so these preemptive power shutoffs, you know, have actually been San Diego Gas and Electric, the utility in San Diego County, has used them a little bit more aggressively than Edison and Pacific Gas and Electric has, and you know, mostly that's been seen as a fairly successful, you know, preventative measure. Although it does cause a lot of headaches and can cause some serious problems for communities during actual disaster situations. What Edison is saying is that it's not actually going to change the criteria that it uses to decide when to do this. So, you know, what they're looking at is when they're very windy, extremely dry conditions in, you know, in these sort of tinderbox areas that are more likely to fuel fires. What they are going to be doing is installing hundreds of new weather stations, weather monitoring stations throughout their service territory over the next 2 years, and infrared cameras so they can, you know, really see their equipment up close and understand what the conditions are and have a better sense of where these sparks are most likely to happen. And what they've acknowledged that basically is that as a result of having this better information, that's going to better inform their ability to do these preemptive shutoffs and will probably lead to more of them, because they'll have this better on-the-ground data about when they need to take that step or when they think they need to.
And how much advance warning is it expected customers will be able to get? Let's say you have, you know, windy, dry conditions. Is there like a sort of general just, hey, we may have to shut it off? And then if they do shut it off, is there any way to contact customers so that they get a heads up, immediately before it happens?
I mean, I think the general guideline that the Public Utilities Commission has that they're supposed to try to abide by is 48 hours of notice when they can do it. Yet if they, if they think these conditions, and this isn't just Edison, this is PG&E and the others as well, that when they see these conditions coming, they're supposed to try to give people, up to 48 hours of advance notice. Of course, when you have these really serious, dangerous weather conditions, I think that, if they think that they're going to start sparking fires, off their grid in the next 6 or 12 or 24 hours or whatever it is, that they're still probably going to, take that step if they think it's necessary. But to the extent possible, 48 hours is supposed to be the standard.
Sammy Roth, LA Times energy reporter with us on Air Talk. And he's laying out for us what the filing was yesterday by Southern California Edison to the State Public Utilities Committee, laying out its fire mitigation plans. This in the wake of utilities in California being blamed for the ignition of massive fires that have led to many deaths as well as billions of dollars in damages from those massive fires, particularly in Northern California. Sammy, what about the inspection of the lines? Because one of the big complaints, particularly about PG&E, has been that they had not kept up with the maintenance of their lines and that made them vulnerable with wind incidents.
Yeah, so it's not really a secret. I mean, PG&E for years now has, it's generally considered to have done a poor job of maintaining its systems, being careful about trees and vegetation that are too close to the lines that may, topple and spark fires when things get windy. And that's actually one of the complaints that some ratepayer groups have about the power shutoff plans. They see this and they say, well, this is only, something that they're doing now because they've done such a poor job of maintaining their system. Really, this shouldn't be necessary so often. They should, have the actual lines hardened in such a way that they don't need to take that step so often. What PG&E is proposing in its plan is that they want to trim or remove up to 375,000 trees in 2019, which is a really big number and significantly more than they've done, in the last few years. Edison also proposing something on that front. They, it's a smaller number than PG&E, but they say they want to trim or remove up to 7,500 trees or potentially more this year, and to inspect 125,000 trees in high-risk areas. So, basically the utilities are both, really stepping that up. I think there's a legitimate argument that probably more of this should have happened already and that they're behind.
I'm guessing that most of that is going to be in more rural areas where you've got, trees coming up under or adjacent to the lines. But does that also mean that Edison is going to be sending more people out into residential neighborhoods and trimming people's trees in their backyards where they're close to power lines?
I would say potentially. I mean, yes, it is more of an issue in rural forested areas, and that's why PG&E, I think, especially has faced has had this issue so much more than the other utilities, because so much of its service territory across Northern and Central California is rural and forested areas. With Edison, they're going to be focusing these efforts on the areas that they've identified as high fire risk, which I think is about a third of their service territory. So, we're probably not talking about like downtown Los Angeles, but to the extent that there are neighborhoods and cities and suburbs that are on that wildland urban interface, as the term goes, yes, you're probably going to be seeing some of this in residential neighborhoods.
All right, and Sammy, with Edison, at this point, they haven't filed for bankruptcy, but what's the sense of their potential exposure or their financial condition given the kinds of, you know, large payouts PG&E has had to do?
Well, so that's a good question. I mean, PG&E is really in trouble for two big reasons. One is that Cal Fire has already determined that its infrastructure was responsible for a dozen of the really devastating fires in fall 2017, which collectively killed 22 people. And meanwhile, it still seems like a strong possibility that they're going to be on the hook for the Camp Fire as well, which was the one that killed 86 people and destroyed the town of Paradise. That determination hasn't been made yet, but there are signs that it might be that PG&E was responsible for sparking that. With Edison, they haven't none of the fires that have been potentially connected to Edison have been quite as devastating as what happened in Northern California. The big one that's sort of hanging over their heads right now is the Woolsey Fire last fall, which was the biggest fire by acreage in Southern California history. That determination has not been officially made yet by Cal Fire, but Edison is already facing all sorts of lawsuits from victims of that fire who are saying basically, either this was your fault or you should have shut off the power beforehand to stop this from happening. You know, PG&E has put this figure out there that they're seeing potentially $30 billion or more in liability for themselves. It's definitely less for Edison. I mean, Edison's stock price has been impacted. Their ability to borrow money and their credit rating has been impacted, but nothing nearly as significant as what's going on with PG&E.
Sammy, thanks so much. Really appreciate your walking us through this mitigation plan filed yesterday by Southern California Edison, which serves the largest portion of Southern California electricity customers. Thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Sammy Roth, energy reporter for the Los Angeles Times. Just 1 minute away, no more, I promise. We'll talk about a call for banning pepper spray in juvenile lockups. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Back in 1 minute. The LA County Inspector General has issued a report to the Board of Supervisors saying that pepper spray is used too frequently, too quickly, and in unnecessary situations in LA County's juvenile halls and camps. The use of pepper spray has reportedly increased dramatically since 2015. Now some are calling for a ban on pepper spray use in juvenile facilities. Joining us from the Children's Defense Fund California, Senior Policy Associate Dominique Nong. Thank you very much, Dominique, for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
First of all, my understanding is that the pepper spray was sort of introduced as a way to avoid using holds that might be even more dangerous for youth to have holds by some of the larger adults who work at these lockup facilities. Is that, in fact, why pepper spray was introduced years ago?
Well, so I have heard that position be made. I couldn't speak particularly to why it started to be used. It is seen as a tool that can be used to help intervene in situations that could require holds. However, the key here is using effective holds, and physical holds sometimes need to be used. But in general, there are situations, there are facilities nationally and in California that have shown that physical holds do not cause more injuries to staff or to youth, and that they are sufficient, along with other more important and preventive techniques, to help manage youth and to protect the safety of youth and staff members.
And what are some of those other techniques that you think would potentially be more effective and less harmful for the kids?
Sure. Broadly speaking, the approach that we're trying to use and to promote would be one that is more proactive than reactive. Chemical spray is a reaction to behavior, and there are a lot of things that both probation departments and line staff and supervisors can use to help prevent the need for these incidents to arise. And in order to do that, there's a lot of training, and something that the Office of the Inspector General really noted is the effective need for training for these probation officers. And the training can include anything from nonviolent crisis interventions to non-threatening verbal and nonverbal de-escalation skills to 7 steps of intervention process. But I think what's also important is, in addition to specific intervention techniques, it would also help probation officers to achieve, to have training and retraining on crisis management, adolescent development, mental and behavioral health, trauma, because the idea is that you need to understand where these teenagers are coming from so that you can approach them with respect and compassion, fairness, consistency, and patience, which is something that we need when we deal with a number of adolescents, not just those that are incarcerated.
I was wondering, looking at the Inspector General's report, and this doesn't speak to whether it's being used unnecessarily or too much pepper spray or at the wrong time, but I was wondering if just the overall use of it might be up because of the changing custodial population. In other words, if you have more, if the teens that are in these facilities now are more violent, worse offenders than we saw in the past, because I think some that were in state custody are now in county custody, might that not explain the fact that pepper spray is much more commonly used now?
So I would sort of push back on the assumption and the description of our young people as, quote unquote, being more worse or more violent. We have to understand that youth behavior is a reaction to a number of things, whether it's previous trauma, whether it's post-traumatic stress disorder, whether it's how they're being treated by staff, the fact that they're away from home. These are very unnatural conditions for young people or anyone to be living in. And so, and rather than focusing on how we classify the young people, we should be focusing on trying to understand why they're behaving that way. And unfortunately, a chemical spray does nothing to really address their underlying behavior and the underlying reasons for why they're acting out in a certain way.
No, and I understand what you're saying about interventions and the stressors that these teenagers experience. I'm just wondering if you've got a higher percentage of them who had acted out violently outside of custody, so then it wouldn't be surprising that a higher percentage are violent in custody.
I don't know if there's a direct translation, because I also do think that when we're talking about young people and how they react outside, we can't necessarily assess the young person's risks and certain needs based only on their offenses. And really, when we're talking about what we're trying to do to achieve, what we're trying to achieve in these facilities, it is about helping these young people and rehabilitating them, building on their strengths and personal growth. And so to do that, you have to really identify the needs of the young people. And really look behind their behavior. And I think that the reaction, the increase in the use of chemical sprays, really isn't so much a reflection of the young people, but is a reflection of the lack of training that staff have to really deal with these young people who are young people like many other people who just have certain needs that need to be addressed and can effectively be addressed without the use of chemical spray.
We're talking with Dominic Ngong, Senior Policy Associate for the Children's Defense Fund California, the nonprofit child advocacy group. Also with us is the immediate past president of the Chief Probation Officers of California. He's Chief Probation Officer for San Luis Obispo County, Jim Salio. Jim, thank you for being with us.
You're welcome.
So we kind of talked about what this L.A. County Inspector General's report indicates. What is your membership's view or the range of view of your officers?
Well, for the Chief Probation Officers of California, you know, our position has been last year and this year, you know, we really need to study the appropriate use of pepper spray and whether it is an effective tool, and what does the evidence say before we make any decisions whether we're going to prohibit the use of pepper spray within juvenile halls. And so are looking to support a bill this year that would look at doing that exact study and then look at the empirical evidence and then make a decision based upon evidence, because probation, really, our mantra is, doing things based upon evidence-based practices.
What are your thoughts about other approaches that might take the place of pepper spray, whether it's using holds to control a young person who's violent, or the proactive things that Dominic Ngong was talking about, de-escalation, talking, you know, through identifying potential problems of acting out before it happens? How effective can those be beyond what's currently practiced?
Well, I agree with Dominic. All those things are really important, and those are being used in juvenile halls. At least I can speak to San Luis Obispo County. We're very proactive and train staff in de-escalation skills, and we use positive behavioral interventions and supports, which is a behavior modification program that we use in our juvenile hall. And those things are all there to help with the minors' behaviors and prevent these kinds of incidents that would require the use of pepper spray. And again, pepper spray is the far end of the spectrum in controlling and use of force. I mean, and the Title 15 regulations, which govern juvenile halls in the state of California, it's very clear that there really has to be an imminent threat to use OC spray. And that's, you know, that's the time when it's used, when there's no other alternative left to stop a minor from hurting themselves or hurting somebody else. And that is the immediate way to stop that behavior. But that's, it's not the... it's not a proactive approach. It's definitely reactive, and we should be doing everything we can to make sure that we don't get to that point, and staff should be using de-escalation skills and trying to understand why the minor is behaving that way. But this is a last resort, and as far as relationship to holds and those kind of things, those are used, too, in juvenile halls and certainly used in our juvenile hall. But sometimes going hands-on is not the safest way to end an immediate threat, and pepper spray is used then to do that. And the use of pepper spray is obviously very closely reviewed and critiqued, and every care is given to the minor who's been exposed to pepper spray.
We're talking with Jim Salio, the immediate past president of the Chief Probation Officers of California. I welcome your thoughts. If you've ever worked in custodial situation for child offenders, I'd be interested in hearing your thoughts about the most effective ways to deal with violent behavior, either proactively or once an incident has begun. What do you think of using holds versus using pepper spray, or what's called OC spray? That stands for oleoresin capsicum, the specific spray that's used here. We're at 866-893-KPECC. 866-893-5722, or the AirTalk page, KPCC. I look forward to hearing from you. We have a listener. I can't bring her up because it's not displaying. Oh, there, I've got it now. I didn't have it available in front of me. Jennifer in Whittier, you're on AirTalk.
Hey, good morning. I used to work for the California Youth Authority as a counselor with juvenile offenders, and I have to say we were exceptionally trained. I had a great unit of people. We were very proactive in trying to prevent fights as best as we could. Our communication skills were excellent. We did a lot of counseling with the wards, but when fights broke out, and oftentimes fights broke out with multiple wards, like 10, 12, sometimes as many as 20 young offenders, 18, 19, 20-year-old young men were talking about fighting, I would never put hands on and risk the safety of myself or even the ward who was fighting. And I think every woman I worked with on that facility felt the same way, that it's just it's a very dangerous situation when they start fighting. And frequently they're fighting over drugs. They're fighting over gang ties. They're not really necessarily fighting over things that you can prevent as a staff person.
Yeah. And so how often did you use pepper spray or something other than a hold to restrain someone who's attacking someone else?
I would guess this was many, many years ago, but I bet I used pepper spray about once every couple months for a fight.
All right. Jennifer, I really appreciate it. Thanks for sharing your experience when you worked at a juvenile hall. Let me go back to Dominic Nong of the Children's Defense Fund California. Your response to what Jennifer described working in a facility.
So I what I heard is that it's certainly the case that it's a very difficult job to work in these facilities. Again, I think it's in a natural place for both staff and for young people. But I would challenge what seems to be an underlying assumption that sometimes these fights are inevitable, and that no matter what, they will be over some of the reasons that she said. There are a number of places and a number of examples, especially, for example, we talked a lot to people in Oklahoma who phase out the use of chemical spray, and they recognize that there are people who may be affiliated with gang members or have other issues that will be going on. If they're talking about drugs or they're talking about gangs, these are things that are in a locked facility that probation should be able to control. It is a controlled environment, so it is the responsibility of all members of the staff to really try to address these underlying reasons that youth are acting up. I think
that's, of course, these things are a serious problem, even at maximum security lockups, where you've got, you know, prison guards have a lot that's available to them there, and still drugs get in, and you still have gang warfare that takes place even in those facilities. So in something that is less stringent, is that realistic to be able to avoid, you know, drugs getting in or territorial disputes?
I do think that there are facilities that show that it can be done, and I think that it is the responsibility of people when we decide as a government to take children into our care, then we are taking on the responsibility of protecting these young people and providing safe, healthy environments for them. But again, it is possible because there are facilities across the nation and in California that are able to prevent these types of things. And it takes a lot of work, and it takes a lot of initiative and creativity, but it can be done.
Jim Saligo, your response to what the listener just described.
Well, you know, and I can empathize with Jennifer because, you know, I've worked at an institution myself, and until you're in there working day in and day out with these youth, and you see sometimes the level of violence that does occur, it's shocking. And, you know, really, you have to stop that violence one way or the other. And OC spray right now for us in San Luis Obispo County is an effective tool to do that. And I think it, in many cases, and I've worked in institutions where we've not had OC spray, and I've worked in institutions where we've had OC spray. And I think the use of OC spray to stop that imminent risk of somebody seriously getting hurt is a much more humane way of dealing with the problem than a bunch of people jumping and grabbing arms and trying to stop a fight. And it's a very, very dangerous situation when you go hands-on. And this way, the immediate effect of OC spray is that it stops the action.
Joseph in Oxnard called, said, I was in juvie for a few years. I noticed a lot of the fights had gang ties, and that was a huge problem. The other problem was that when pepper spray was used, it would get everywhere. I would get sprayed accidentally sometimes. I think it's used a bit too much, but it does help guards with safety and breaking up fights. That's Joseph in Oxnard describing his experience being in a juvenile facility for several years. 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722, or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Should pepper spray be banned from use in juvenile detention facilities, or does that actually put the youth and employees at a greater risk of physical harm if pepper spray is not available? 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page. And if you have experience either being in custody in a lockup when you were a minor, or if you're someone who's worked in a facility like that, I welcome your input and your thoughts on this. Jim Saligo, can you take us through sort of what the steps are prior to the use of OC spray to get control on a violent incident?
Sure. Well, obviously, let's take a fight, for instance. So obviously, the first thing you're going to do is give a verbal command and you know, tell them to stop fighting, and hopefully that stops the behavior. But if it doesn't, then you really look at the staff you have available around you. Are there enough staff to break up the fight going hands-on? Is it not safe? And then at that point, it becomes what is the best force option? And if OC is available, that might be the best force option to stop the fight. So your immediate task you're set to is to, how do I stop this fight? How do I stop somebody from getting hurt? And what's the best way to do it in the safest manner possible? And those are the things that you all have to take into consideration. And those things are split-second decisions that officers have to make in the heat of the moment that's happening. And it's a very difficult job and something that it requires a lot of training, which officers get. There's a required core curriculum that all institutional officers have to have, and they're trained in these things, and they're trained over and over again every year, because they have to have 20 hours of training every year in these areas. So
what's the turnover in the probation officer workforce? I would assume it's a fairly high burnout rate.
Well, the institution, so in probation, there's in every county, there's two classifications. There's the probation officers who really are the ones that are, you think of more traditionally working with people on probation in the field. And then we have the juvenile correctional officer positions that work in the institutions. And those are usually a beginner entry level type position. And so there tends to be more turnover in those positions, mainly because people are promoting from those positions to become deputy probation officers. So there is very much a high turnover rate throughout the state of California, and certainly in many counties, large vacancy rates.
So that's you got a training challenge just by virtue of new people coming in.
Absolutely.
All the time. Yeah, Jim Salio, thank you so much. Good to have you with us. He's the immediate past president of the Chief Probation Officers of California. And my thanks to the Children's Defense Fund California Senior Policy Associate Dominique Nong, the organization advocating for eliminating pepper spray usage in lockups for minors. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Coming up, our reporter Jill Replogle going 30 days without single-use plastic containers. How did she do that? We'll find out after a live update from Tammy Trujillo. While we're on the subject of the Theater at Ace Hotel, that's where I'll be, and I hope to see you there Sunday afternoon, February 17th, our 17th annual Film Week Academy Awards preview. As in prior years, our critics come together on stage at the Ace. We'll watch clips from the Oscar-nominated Best Pictures, and we'll have a chance for members of the audience to ask questions, too. Last year sold out. This is your chance to get your tickets and make sure you're there. Visit kpcc.org/in-person. Sunday afternoon, February 17th, 1 o'clock, Theater at Ace Hotel, downtown L.A. It's exactly 1 week before the Oscars are handed out in Hollywood. Well, Jill Replogle, KPCC's Orange County reporter, undertook an experiment with her family of four. She and her husband and their two children decided that they would live the month of January using as little single-use plastic as possible. She's sharing her story with KPCC listeners and going to go in depth with us this morning on Air Talk. Jill, welcome.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
So what was the genesis of this idea, and how hard to sell was it to your family?
Well, you know, we live near the beach. We go to the beach a lot, as lots of people have found out if they've gone out to the beach this week or after any rains. The beaches are littered with plastic. And, you know, so it's become increasingly obvious that we have a problem. You know, a couple of years ago, China, which used to take most of our recycling, stopped taking basically the world's trash for recycling. And that has left California and the United States and many countries with a big pileup. And, you know, scientists are kind of starting to quantify also how much plastic is out there. And, you know, it's thought that by 2050, there could be more plastic in the ocean than fish. And so, you know, a lot of this comes down to the products that we see every day, either that is packaged in plastic, that comes in plastic, that is wrapped in plastic. And so we wanted to see what could we do on a personal level to try to reduce that. And, you know, how hard is it to find alternatives?
Yeah, I was imagining myself trying to do what you describe in your reporting on this, because there's so many things that I buy at the supermarket that come in single-use plastic containers. Use the example of salsa. Yeah, I could get it in a jar, but the fresh salsa's in a plastic single-use container. I don't have time to make my own. So, you know, the alternatives are very limited in cases like that. So how did you strategize being able to do this without having a huge impact on what you consumed?
We bought a lot of stuff in bulk. I mean, the first thing we did before the month started was to order a bunch of stuff on Amazon, which also came wrapped in a bunch of plastic, I got to say. But, you know, we...
so that you cheated. You did that in December?
That was in December, yeah. But because it's hard to find some of these things, like reusable produce bags. And so, you know, we got a set of produce bags that we could take to the store and, you know, put our carrots and stuff right in there as opposed to grabbing those flimsy plastic bags. We got kind of all our containers, reusable containers in the house together. And so when we would go on a shopping trip, we would bring all of our reusable bags and those containers and, you know, get stuff from the bulk section. So that's where we got most of the snacks for kids. We found a store called BYO Long Beach in, you know, real close to us that sells detergent and hand soap and shampoo and kind of just like all sorts of things that you could need on the kind of cleaning and personal care side in bulk. And so, again, you bring your own container and you fill up there and they charge you for the weight of it. There are a couple of those in L.A., too. It's becoming more of a thing. So, you know, we did have to kind of really try to plan out our meals and stuff for the week. But that's we did not execute perfectly, I should say. You know,
I think that would be impossible. So we won't hold you to that standard. But clearly you made significant progress, it sounds like. And I'd love to hear from listeners who've tried to do just what Jill is describing with her family. And what did you find were some of the biggest obstacles? Were there surprises for you when you undertook this challenge? Are there things that you've tried workarounds that just have not been effective? What has been your experience if you've tried to eliminate single-use plastic from your consumer life? 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722, or the AirTalk page, kpcc.org. It sounds like since you were switching to bulk purchases, particularly of food, that it did have a limiting effect on what would be available to you. How much did you feel that?
Yeah, I mean, we definitely gave some things up. I mean, just one example, rice cakes. My kids like rice cakes, okay? You know, they come in the plastic bag, and then they're also packaged in more plastic inside.
Styrofoam inside styrofoam.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, we gave up some stuff like that. We made things. Like, it's actually really easy to make yogurt. So, you know, we made yogurt. We made hummus. What else do we make? We made ketchup. That didn't go over so well with the kids. But so, you know, we made a lot of things. We did give up other things.
But would you have time beyond a month to continue to make all that stuff?
No. And, that's one of, you know, we work hard. We already had, I think, some of these habits before. We like to cook. We like to make things. But it's time consuming. And we had to go out of the way to get certain things that just don't make sense either for, you know, a busy family or because you're going to waste the gas mileage, you know, and increase your greenhouse gas emissions that way to go out of your way to buy something that's not convenient. So, but really that was the point, right? To figure out, you know, how practical is, how much do we depend on plastic and where are all the alternatives and how can we reduce? And is it really a personal decision or do we need to think more systemically?
And how do you balance the water usage of washing reusable plastic bags versus, the landfill of putting stuff into the trash? How do you balance that?
That's a good question. And it, people who have done studies on this kind of thing, like, for example, diapers, cloth diapers is sort of a big debate in the environmental world. Is it actually better to wait, you know, use the water and sometimes bleach and things that we put into the, you know, the laundry machine to use cloth diapers as opposed to plastic? It's debated, and it kind of depends where you live and how valuable water is. Valuable is also obviously very, important here in California. But there are non-plastic alternatives. And you know, the thing about plastic is that it is around for a very long time, an estimated, 450 years to possibly never biodegrading in the environment. So, but there are alternatives. There's paper. There's other, I went to a Super Bowl party the other day that had avocado pit spoons. So,
I've seen those, yeah.
Yeah. And I think, there's more of a push, and especially among environmentalists, to really try to get manufacturers to think about better alternatives, better things that we can use for, the single-use things that we're still going to do. Like, we still want to go to our taco truck and be able to get something there.
Jill Rettbogl, KPCC Orange County reporter. She, her husband, and their two kids lived the month of January pretty much without single-use plastic as part of their consumer lives. And we're hearing the pros and cons of that, what they gave up, what the trade-offs were. I'd like to hear from you if you've tried something similar. Maybe it wasn't confined to a month. Maybe you do this on an ongoing basis. What does it cost you in time? What are some of the trade-offs in doing it? And what would you like to see provided, whether it's places that sell in bulk or other things, that would make it easier for you to be able to live without single-use plastic as a part of your life? 866-893-KPCC. We'll be back in 1 minute on Air Talk. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle. Very good to have you with us. We're talking about the scourge of single-use plastic for consumers and what the alternative is if you try and live without single-use plastic as a part of your life. We're at 866-893-KPECC. Kudos to Jill Replogle. She and her family signed on to do this in the month of January. Violet, in Huntington Beach, what's your experience with this?
So what we're trying to do in our family is we're trying to eliminate plastic altogether. And we've done that starting in small steps. So when we go to the dry cleaner, we ask for our clothes to not be put in plastic and they have a special place where they've accommodated us so that our clothes come just on the hangers. And my husband then hangs his shirts up and we recycle the hangers as well. The other thing that we've done is Albertsons in our neighborhood has been very gracious. If we have any plastic from packaging, so from big boxes, from anything, we take that soft packaging plastic and we bring it to Albertsons. They actually bundle it with all of their packaging plastic and they resell those pallets into recycling. We don't take any money for them. We just feel like that's good stewardship on our part to help the planet. And the third thing that we do is we have eliminated any use of straws and we each carry glass straws with us so that and for our drinks and such, we don't use any straws whatsoever. So every little bit helps.
Violet, I appreciate it. Thanks for sharing your family's experience with this. During our last member drive, we offered the KPCC reusable straw. Yeah. And I've seen people using it in the little pouch. It looks like drug paraphernalia, but people pull out their reusable straw. That's funny. Violet, thanks so much. I appreciate it. Let's see. Let's talk with Terry in Tustin. Terry, what are the ways you and your family attempt to go single-use plastic-free?
So a few years ago, I gave my wife a little gift, and I call it a takeaway kit. And it's basically a zippered cold bag, and we stock it up with glass snapware, which is kind of like Tupperware, only it's see-through. And it's ready to put right in the fridge. And we bring that to restaurants because we typically eat half a meal. They serve so much. And we don't need to use their styrofoam and stuff.
All right. And so you actually walk in with your doggy bag, so to speak, so that you can take out your leftovers. Have you had any comments about that from restaurant staff?
Well, everybody seems to think it's really a cool idea, and we go, oh, cool, people are going to start adopting this. And we never see anybody else do it. So I thought maybe if they hear it on the radio.
I have heard of other people doing it.
Have you? Yeah. Yeah. Is that something you would consider, Jill, when
yeah.
you go out to dinner?
Oh, yeah, for sure. I actually just put, because someone, I joined a couple, there's a couple of Facebook groups that, strategize how to reduce waste, how to do zero waste living. And somebody had suggested tiffins, they're kind of these stackable tin containers, and so I have one of those in my car now for if I need to get taken.
Very good, and you just take it in the restaurant. Terry, thanks so much. Good to have you with us. And I think he said he's been doing this for 4 or 5 years, so he was an early adopter. Med in Lincoln Heights in L.A., you're on Air Talk.
Hi, I just wanted to also talk briefly about my personal experience with trying to eliminate single-use straw or plastics in general. And the one thing that I've found, I've been doing this for a while now, is that it's incredibly hard simply because everywhere you go, you pretty much have to carry lots of stuff with you. Like, for example, yeah. at a restaurant, if I want to eat something, the first thing they're going to offer me is plastic forks, plastic spoons, plastic cups, et cetera. So I carry a mug with me. I carry a fork with me, et cetera. So one of the things that I would love to see happen throughout LA and frankly everywhere else is, you know, have establishments, companies, businesses that are plastic responsible. They don't necessarily offer you these kinds of things unless it's absolutely necessary. And as far as like the whole plastic straw movement goes, or eliminating plastic straws, it's really confusing to me because why do we need straws to begin with? Unless you're a little kid, you do not need a straw.
Because people that are uncoordinated like me drinking an iced drink will tip the cup too far and have the ice hit them in the face. You're coordinated enough, you don't need a straw. But for lamos like me, I need it. Thank you, Matt. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Suzanne in Santa Monica says, farmers markets, you can take your own bags there. And that's, you know, that's sort of the most pure example of what you're talking about, Jill.
Yeah. Also because, you know, the little produce stickers on most of the produce that you get at the grocery store, most of those are also made out of plastic.
866-893-KPECC. Let's see. Let's talk next with Christina in Seal Beach. Christina, welcome.
Hi, thank you.
Yeah, what's your experience with this?
Well, what I was calling in about is that, you know, right now I'm at a water market that's close to Seal Beach where we fill up our water jugs and then we use those to fill up our water bottles that we use for the day. And our kids are using cleanable, reusable water bottles every day, as well as in their lunches they have reusable plastic containers for everything. We don't use single-use plastics for the kids' lunches, and definitely not water bottles. I mean, that's such an easy one for businesses, for, you know, even at KPCC, I would hope you guys don't have water bottles.
I have one in front of me right now. That's what I use every day.
I don't.
Yeah. We offered it to Jill, but she didn't take it. Yeah, because for guests, it's so much easier to give them, because they take then what they don't finish. We'd love to, you know, afford to give them their own reusable KPCC water container. That'd be a little expensive to do that every day. Christina, thanks so much. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. But of course, one of the things to mention is the greater Los Angeles area has some pretty excellent tasting tap water. You put a filter on it, and really no reason to have to use bottled water. If, you know, you're at home, you take your filtered water out, and it's very high quality. 866-893-KPECC. Lenny, in the Miracle Mile District, you wanted to point out that Germany is trying something with this. What do they do there?
Well, it's not just this, it's with everything. And I think to put the onus on the individual is wrong. What happens with every product should be it is priced neutral in nature to neutral in nature. If you put something in the consumption stream, you need to deal with its aftermath. You build a washing machine, you put plastic, whatever, it needs to be priced. And when the price goes up, people's behavior will change. But plastic is perceived as being free, and we are deferring it to a generation in the future that will have to deal with it.
All right, Lenny, I appreciate it. Thank you so much. Great to have you with us. Aaron in Valley Village says, camping mess are excellent to have because they lock. You also have metal utensils. Also understanding why delis at grocery stores still use the old Chinese takeout boxes, which are very wasteful. That's Aaron in Valley Village. And Jennifer in Culver City says, I've been doing this for a long time. I used to get weird looks at the grocery store when I said, no bags. Jennifer, thanks very much. Jill, thank you. Really appreciate your sharing in a bit more depth your experience with your family going single-use plastic-free for January.
Thanks for having
been
me.
Been fun. Jill Rep, local, you hear her covering Orange County for us right here at 89.3 KPECC. Fresh Air with Terry Gross is next. She'll be talking about the latest in the Mueller investigation with the New York Times, Michael Schmidt. Look forward to talking with you tomorrow morning at 10 for the next Air Talk and Film Week at 11 o'clock tomorrow.